This is an Enterprise Times security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Derek Mankey from Fortinet.
Hi, how are you doing? It's a pleasure to be here. I've been with Fortinet 15 years. I started myself as a threat analyst, researcher, so doing reverse engineering, working within our FortiGuard lab department. We had about 20 people in our SOC back then. Now we've grown to including developers, QA that we're doing just following cybercrime. We're over 200 now globally. That's at about 6,000 employees at Fortinet. So it's been a big ride over 15 years, and obviously technology has adapted quite a bit with that. I still direct our analyst team and lab, so basically finding what are the latest happenings in terms of the threat landscape. But myself now, I do a lot of external engagements, so I'm consulting a lot, working with C-suite executives to do advice based off of latest trends and techniques, looking at the current threat landscape, but also what's in store for the future too, thinking not necessarily just looking into the crystal ball, but based off educated guesses of what we're doing when it comes to data analysis, threat analysis, and things like that.
One of the biggest things we've seen over the last few years is the snake oil artificial intelligence solve everything cybersecurity solution. Many of them have very limited data sets, they're unproven, their intelligence is questionable. How do we put some proper scope on what we're doing?
Yeah, it's more like AA, artificial algorithms, not intelligence as much. You're right. I share that view. There's a lot of what we call bingo buzzwords out there, buzzword bingo. A lot of people synonymously use the word AI when, in fact, in reality, a lot of it is just automation, using algorithms, throwing in some if-then, do this, based off some data or some inputs that are coming in. The reality is that to have true artificial intelligence, you need three key factors. You need data, quality of data, especially when it comes to the pool of data for the type of application that you're trying to put it towards. Make sure that it is obviously relevant and wide enough. The second element that you need is processing power. Obviously, that was one of the key challenges when Alan Turing started talking about artificial intelligence back in the 40s and when it was founded as a practice at Dartmouth College. They didn't really have the power at the time that we need for today's applications. The third thing is time. And when we talk about artificial intelligence, we talk about machine learning, and machines learn like humans do, albeit they can learn quicker in some applications, but it still takes time. In our case, we've deployed an AI system with machine learning models. It took us over 5 years of learning. We're talking about pumping malware files through it on a daily basis, 5 years of that of learning until we could actually start trusting. And we could talk about that more because trust is a big element, but it takes time. So when you see a lot of vendors talking about AI, in reality, they don't have all those elements in play.
Let's take this back a bit. Machine learning, we kind of understand. We've got to have a lot of data, we throw it out, and we let the machine pull this data together, hopefully create some new connections in the data, and if we're really lucky, it will find context around those connections. But what constitutes enough data for that first level of machine learning? Is it a couple of hundred gigabytes? Is it a few terabytes? Is it several exabytes? What do we need, and how do we start with it?
I guess the answer to that question is it completely depends on the application. For us, we're dealing with cybersecurity. So we're looking at how we mitigate threats. It can also be about detection. In the world of cybersecurity, you basically come from two different arms. You come from a detection standpoint back in the world when IDS, so intrusion detection systems, were born before IPS, before intrusion prevention. Why? Because at that time, a lot of the data that was being put into it, simple algorithms and rules being written for intrusion detection systems, had a lot of false positives. So they didn't really trust it until modern practices started to be put in and IPS was born. It's the same sort of idea when it comes to using machine learning models. At first, a lot of it is about detection, passive data passing detection events to human network admins or security analysts in security operations centers so that they could block it. It really depends on the data set when it comes to that. For us, as an example, we're starting with antivirus for our application of AI. Our entire malware collection, we're dealing with close to a petabyte. We're about 900 terabytes. And think about each virus sample. They're small. They're about 50 kilobytes maybe in size. There's a lot of samples in there, and we're getting north of a million new samples a day coming into our lab now. We started using automation initially. Now we have some applications of AI. Our machine learning models are being trained on data sets. Our approach to that is using supervised learning because there's also unsupervised learning models. That's more like weather modeling. It's good for detection, but not so much for mitigation. So we're just taking a mitigation approach. And what we do is we will feed a whole bunch of tag data into our systems. Our systems and analysts are confident that this is bad code. The system will start learning off that bad code through artificial networks that we have. After a while, about 3 weeks' time, we'll actually start flushing that. Basically, when I say flush, we will start testing the systems. The system will say, with random data, so it's not tagged, the system will say, it's verdict or decision, this is bad, this is good. Our analysts will actually look at that. and then correct the system if it's wrong. So it's sort of flushing its memory of incorrect data off the machine learning models. For us, in terms of the size of data, we'd be in the terabytes range, not a petabyte, just for the A-B practice. But it's taken 5 years for us to have the systems learning about the bad code. What we've done, this is the artificial intelligence part, because we talked about automation versus AI. What we've done is when the system is actually determining a new random sample is bad, it's actually writing in a predicate language that we've developed. It's pretty basic still, but it's something that we actually train our analysts to write in. It's not just a signature. It's actually looking at different parts of code, and it's deployed to our product so that it can actually block this code. So our analysts will typically write in that. It's called CPRL. It's a compact pattern recognition language. When the AI system is actually determining a new sample is malicious, it will actually write some basic patterns in this language, and then that will be deployed into our product base. So it's the crawl, walk, run I always talk about. We're definitely not into any sort of Skynet scenario when it comes into this stuff, but some basic elements, yeah.
When you talk about correcting it, clearly you need transparency. And it's one of those difficult conversations at the moment around companies when you get to AI. Many think in order to run quickly, it has to be allowed to run itself. But there's a lot of fear about what it may do, what it may not do. Is the decision right? Is the decision wrong? How much of a challenge was that for you internally to decide that you needed transparency to understand not just how it got to a decision, but to understand the context around that decision so that you could then improve the training?
Oh, it's critical. We obviously need to learn. Well, there's a couple of things. One, what data that we're submitting. There's also a privacy element of that, so we can talk about that as well, because how we train the systems on data, we have to obviously select the pool of data that's being submitted. So we can't submit things like customer data, and that's why we start with antivirus in our case, because we're just looking at pure blocks of malicious code. But when it comes to transparency, we need people who understand the machine learning models, the algorithms, how it's coming to decisions, and exactly how those decisions are made. It's very important, especially for our developers, but our analysts, to work closely with the developers to understand how that system is making its decisions. It's very important. Yeah.
Context is something you mentioned, something I asked about just then. If we're going to expect these systems to make decisions, they also need to understand context. And context is not a simple thing to understand. How did you begin to educate your system on what context was real and what context wasn't real?
That kind of comes back to the data tagging I was talking about. That's a form of context, because we're saying here is a payload, or let's say code, and here is some context based off of our human intelligence. So either this is good or this is bad. In between, so if you look at an artificial neural network, it has an input layer and output layer. It's binary. But on the inside, you have all of these nodes that are connected, and those nodes provide the context. In the implementation of our artificial neural network, the nodes are actually features. So it's actually blocks of code that it's looking at and saying this is bad or this is good. We have about 9 billion of those nodes running in our network. And so those are 9 billion features. And it's like neurons in the human body. They're all interconnected. It's like a mesh network. So there's a ton of context happening there, because it's saying that's all the code decision trees in the middle. But the output of our system, incredibly complex inner layers, but the output is a 0-1. Is it bad or is it not bad? But the context inside is done through a lot of the different machine learning models, the implementations of that, how it builds context, stores that context in the system. A lot of that is just tracing code blocks through execution and things like this.
Now, you have the advantage. You start, as you said, with a bunch of known entities. You knew what they were. You knew which were good, which were bad. You knew how they related to each other. When we look at organizations beginning to take on AI themselves, they often don't have that fine, granular set of data to begin with. So how should they begin to approach this whole subject of should they just go with a simple machine learning? Should they rush into an AI solution? And more importantly, how do they scale that into their security area as opposed to general IT?
It's a good question. It's a tough question. A couple of things. One, in my general experience, there is a severe lack of skilled professionals, even in security, when it comes to analysts, into data science as an example, too. That's obviously a key element to this, too, let alone AI and machine learning experts. A, that's challenge number one, is finding people who are experienced enough to be able to build these systems, run these systems. Right now, a lot of the vendors taking this on from a cybersecurity perspective. It really depends on the organizations, too. If we're talking about SMB organizations, small and medium businesses, even non-large enterprise, generally, a lot of these organizations won't have very large security operations centers or development resources. It's more of a working, like a collaborative exercise, how they can work with existing solution sets, usually services through managed security service providers, telcos, carriers, things like that. That's just a first thought on that. The other part is, okay, if you do have the resources and you want to take this on, again, it comes down to those three elements. You have to be able to, A, define a clear scope of how you want to apply the AI, define how you're going to actually start trusting that in terms of implementation, define the data sets as well. Where is your data pool? How large is that data pool? If you don't have a large data pool, again, the machine learning systems just aren't going to work. They're going to be very prone to false positives. Going to our example with AV, when we started with machine learning on antivirus, in the first week, as an example, it had a very, very high false positive rate because it wasn't trained. It had a very limited scope of knowledge. Of course, after a five-year period and after a whole bunch of that correction and training, it got into a very confident rating, so less false positives. My recommendation is you have to have the resources. You have to be able to willing to put those resources into it if you have a clear scope. And with those resources, the best approach is to take a supervised learning approach too. So you're going to have someone. It's like a parent and a child relationship. You're going to have someone working with those systems, training those systems from an operational perspective. And you're also going to have the resources to develop that too. When it comes to security, typically, when it comes to doing things like mitigation, you're looking at using artificial intelligence to look at things like web traffic. Is this a malicious website? Certainly antivirus as well. Things that are more prone to false positives like vulnerabilities, so exploits and vulnerabilities and IPS. I haven't really seen a lot of good solutions out there yet for that, so that's kind of more ambitious, I'd say, down the line, yeah.
I'm kind of pleased that you mentioned SOCs, MSSPs, telcos, because these people are going to build their data pool by aggregating data across a bunch of customers, which raises a significant problem at the moment. We have very strong privacy laws coming in. The GDPR is now in force across Europe. We see California and the main federal government in the US starting to look at this. We look at India, Singapore, China, Australia. How do we begin to aggregate enough data? Because in order to get context, fully anonymized data isn't the best source.
That's a very good point. It comes down to aggregating the data and access to the data. What data should be accessed, what should not be accessed. That's a very big conversation. I've been to a lot of conferences, a lot of people talking about that. It's definitely a challenge that hasn't been cracked, in my opinion. Some ways that we're trying to tackle that, as an example, we're a founding member. NTT Security is also part of the Cyber Threat Alliance too. So this is a alliance of vendors that are getting together to share data that can be focused to specific applications. In our case, we're looking at IOCs, indicators of compromise. It comes down to security elements. We're not tying in context to customers, as an example. We just can't do that. That would breach GDPR laws, things like this. So in case of a Cyber Threat Alliance, what we can do is actually share data on attack techniques, as an example, or malicious sites that we see. Not that this person visited this malicious site, because that's context that would breach data privacy laws, but looking at more of just, we think this is a bad site because it has this bad code in it, that sort of stuff. We're enabling access to global data sets that way. We implement things like TLP, like traffic light protocol. So that's confidentiality, what can be shared, what cannot be shared, things like that. So there's technical solutions to it, but it's still a very big problem in terms of anonymizing data from contextual data sets, as an example.
But one of our goals in security is to attribute an attack. We're looking to find out what we know about the attacker, who was the attacker. When we look at indicators of compromise, well, the first thing we do is we look for IP addresses. We look to relate those IP addresses then to domain records. Even with privacy on domain records, there are mechanisms that allow us to find out who owns that record. We then look for secondary data that confirms or denies. We're already in the realm of privacy data. How do we keep that separate? Can we keep that separate and do our job?
It's another tough question. Attribution, from our point of view, is always one of the most rewarding things you can do, but one of the most challenging because of that access to data sets. In our case, we're not law enforcement, so we can do a whole bunch of great research and we can say, hey, we know this attack originated from here, but then we can't take it any further. If there's things like NATed IPs or tracing through routing hops, like things like that, we just can't do. We've taken an approach to actually do collaborative approaches, as an example. We have an information sharing agreement with Interpol, so I'm on an expert working group there. We've actually done some attribution cases. It's hard though. It's very hard because as security researchers, we're bound by laws. So it makes our job tough. We can't hack hackers. We're not allowed to do that. Now, the good news is they get lazy a lot of the times and they have open servers so that you can just go and access logs and find information that's publicly available because they're sloppy in what they do. But there are a lot of barriers. Getting back to your question, it's A, we need to be able to continue at least to maintain pace and operate what we're doing on that basic level, I would say, because we have enjoyed some success with that. But the reality is that there are a lot of barriers in terms of data flow, data access, and privacy laws do make that. I'm not saying they're not necessary, but it makes it all that much tougher for us to operate, yeah.
So where does AI help and hinder? If we look at a lot of this process, it can be a very manual process, very intensive, a lot of people involved trying to sift data. It clearly makes sense for us to use an educated system that can filter that and help us get to where we need to be. But at the same time, a human element looking at this will be able to look at something and say, whoa, hang on, I'm stepping over a line between anonymous and not anonymous data. Is there a privacy implication? An automated system wouldn't necessarily understand that. It has a goal that it is trying That's to seek right. to get to. How do you make a balance between those?
I see AI as, again, we talked about that silver bullet. It's definitely not a silver bullet. It can be a powerful tool. I look at AI as a tool. Case in point, that again, from our perspective, we've used it as a tool to be able to help repurpose the day-to-day stuff that our analysts would do. Writing this programming language I was talking about, they can take over some of those cycles. We need good people because there's a gap in professionals, like we said, so we're definitely not laying off people. In fact, we need to hire more people, but we're repurposing how they do that. It's the same thing with AI. I think when it comes to data science, as an example, I think that as we go through experience with AI, using this as a tool, it's going to light up a lot of bulbs. In our world, again, we look at threats. It's what I refer to as threat illumination, because it's giving our human eyes focus or a light onto things that a puzzle, let's say, the aspects of that were already there, but we just didn't see it before. In terms of data privacy, the AI systems will actually start showing some gaps, some issues that we have when it comes to data privacy, to be able to identify, let's say, violations of that, and then be able to take that out of data models or training sets. That'll be a first learning experience with AI, being able to actually use it to improve these processes that we have. Because nothing's perfect and these processes aren't perfect. So I think we're going to have some issues with that off the bat. One other thing I'll say with that quickly is it's all about how these AI systems learn. Again, it comes down to the data. How do we train these systems? How we retain the data in systems, data that's acceptable in terms of privacy, and how we strip off data that's not acceptable. Another thing, because I work on our forward-looking predictions, there's a couple of interesting things I'm looking at, including applications of offensive AI. That's a whole another interesting area to talk about. Because in our experience, it's always a cat and mouse game. There's a tool. We can use it for good. They can use it for evil. And certainly that applies with AI. And I'm not talking about Terminator and Skynet again, but things with security. But one of the main challenges we're going to be up against is what I refer to as machine learning poisoning. Mm-hmm. You can almost think of unintentional poisoning when it comes to feeding, say, sensitive data into a system that should be stripped, because that's learning bad things in terms of a privacy aspect. From our side of the house, dealing with attackers, I think we're going to be up against that too. Instead of attackers try to defeat an AI system on the forefront, i.e. the AI system blocking its code when it's in transit, going after the Achilles heel and actually poisoning the machine learning models themselves. So the system thinks everything is good when it's not. That's another interesting scenario, the challenges we're going to be up against, I think.
I think it's going to be very interesting this year to see how all of this begins to play out.
Yeah, yes.
Derek, thank you for your time.
No problem. It's a pleasure.